shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Good evening. This is Brother Mike of Kingdom Identity Ministries welcoming you to another one of our First Sunday Live Kingdom Concepts broadcasts. We're being heard tonight over WWCR, both transmitter 3 and 4. That's 4.840 megahertz and 5.890 megahertz. And also WVCQ, which is 7.490 megahertz. Both of those stations have an internet link that you can listen to, but you can get your best internet link directly from our studio by going to our radio page. Go to kingidentity.com and then go to the radio page. And under Kingdom Concepts, down near the bottom, you'll see two different links, one for Windows Media and one for WinApp, and that's the clearest link. If you'd like to participate in tonight's broadcast, you can call toll-free 877-924-7722 or 888-656-4115. I'll repeat those numbers, 877-924-7722, that's 877-YAWS-RACE, or 888-656-4115. We're going to be talking about an important subject tonight, and a very interesting subject. Our people have been controlled primarily through three means, religiously, politically, and monetarily. The religious and political are talked about often in the establishment press and, of course, in the Patriot press. But monetarily, that's not mentioned too much, and often the Patriots who do mention it have a lot of misconceptions. Therefore, our speaker, author, tonight, and authority on biblical lawful money, and a longtime friend will touch on this subject. I'd like to welcome Bruce McCarthy to the broadcast.
Thank you, Mike. How are you?
Just fine. How are you doing?
Doing fine. Thank you.
Why don't you start out by telling us a little bit of what distinguishes lawful biblical money from the type of money that man has created?
Certainly. There are quite a few actual distinctions between lawful money and what I call legal plunder, kind of a play on words for legal tender. First off, the source of lawful money differs from the source of legal tender. God is the source of what we use as lawful money, since to use something as money in conformity with the commandment to have just weights and measures presupposes that there be something that can, in fact, be weighed and measured. What we have historically used as a people, ever since the early days of Genesis, going back approximately 6,000 years from today, has been gold and silver, and then for small purchases, we've used brass or with copper, which is the primary element in brass. In fact, gold, silver, and brass were the first three substances which God had commanded Moses to accept as offerings from his Israelite people. On the other hand, the source of what we use today, and what we use today is not money, but is credit. The system operates and has operated on 100% credit since approximately 1965. And prior to that time, most of our transactions for the previous, maybe 50 years, had been dollars of credit, not dollars of any monetary substance. But the source of credit is man, specifically banker man, who I call the God man. The substantive money conforms, as I mentioned before, to the law of just weights and measures. Credit, however, which is intangible, you cannot see, smell, hear, taste, or touch it. It does not respond to any of the five human senses. It is not a gas, liquid, or a solid. It is not counted among the elements in the periodic chart, along with various metals, like iron and silver and gold and uranium and so forth. That does not conform to, need not conform to, the law of just weights and measures. Those are two primary distinctions I guess we could make right from the very beginning without me getting too long-winded.
I guess that originally some notes were issued on actual substance, and then more notes were issued than the substance of gold or silver. And well, today they're just issuing pure credit. Would you like to go into that?
Yeah, I mean, the system that we had from the days of Abram, for example, we know back in the early days of, I think around Genesis 13 or thereabouts, that Abram, before his name was changed to Abraham, was very rich in cattle and in silver and in gold. So the items in value went from the lesser, which was cattle, to the silver, which was a little bit more, and gold was the highest. We know from Genesis chapter 2, verse 11 and 12, for example, that in the land of Havilah there was gold, and the gold of that land, says the Word of God, was good. Down through the ages, you know, King David, King Solomon, in fact, the Federal Reserve says that the gold of King Solomon's day is still with us. His gold is a very, not only highly prized metal, but it's very durable. There's almost nothing that will destroy it. It won't rust. I mean, you can throw it into the ocean. You know, barnacles will probably cling to it. But if you find it 1,000 years later, you can haul it out of the ocean, kick the barnacles off the gold coin, and you still have a gold coin, which is more than you can say for a Federal Reserve note or even a plastic debit card that lays claim to some sort of a numerical account at some bank, which probably won't be here for much longer when God gets finished with them. But, historically, gold and silver have been used as money. In fact, the word money in the Hebrew is the same word that we find translated in the King James, silver. It's the Hebrew word kesef, number 3701 in Strong's. And we have several hundred instances where the words money and silver are used. And almost without exception, there are maybe four exceptions to that rule, it's the same word, kesef, which actually means silver. There are a couple exceptions to that rule, and that's the word kesetah, which simply means an ingot. And Federal Reserve notes, to the best of my knowledge, don't come in ingot form, but silver certainly does. But again, historically, gold and silver have been used as money, and as other elements in the realm of commodities for thousands of years. But in the last several hundred, it became rather fashionable for certain reasons to issue promissory notes against deposited gold or silver. And the unfortunate thing about that, because of the sin nature of man, those who could issue those IOUs had a distinct proclivity to issue far more IOUs than there was gold or silver on deposit. That has been, historically, since we've ever had Federal Reserve notes, U.S. notes, and other types of circulating debt instruments going back to 1690 in America to the first colony of Massachusetts, which began issuing bills of credit, there have always been overissues of those. And it has always been the overissuance of the credit instrument, and not the gold or the silver which is on deposit, which has caused our problem. And Americans seem to stagger like a drunken sailor between hard money, gold and silver, and credit, seemingly unable to make a determination as to which way we really ought to go. And every time we ran into a credit problem, we had about 6 credit crises during the 1800s, which resulted in various panics like 1890, 1857, for example, 1837, even before that. Each of those crises were caused by banks, bankers, and banking. and an overissuance of credit instruments. But each time, the bankers blamed the depositors for losing confidence in the system, because it is a confidence game. And without the confidence factor, the system does tend to kind of unravel after a while. It's been a progressive...
Economic crisis is be engineered on purpose in order to foreclose, perhaps, and take more control over the people?
Yeah, there's no doubt that banks profit. Not all banks, because we have seen banks that have collapsed in these various crises down through the years. I mean, hundreds of banks collapsed during the Great Depression of 1929. So one might look at those instances and say, well, surely the banks that collapsed didn't want to collapse. And I would have to agree with that. But there are those within the banking fraternity who did engineer collapse. And part of the purpose was not only to acquire, in the 1929 crisis, to acquire the American public's gold, because in 1934, that's when the American public's gold was confiscated, but also to merge and consolidate all of the underling banks, if you will. In fact, the Federal Reserve System was created basically to regulate any potential competitors and even drive them out of the market, because the Federal Reserve System ultimately became the only bank in the United States which could operate on a 0% reserve requirement. All of the other banks have been given a limit as to how much they can cheat. And it was after the Jimmy Carter administration, when he left office, that he left a bank deregulation bill, or law, I should say, I guess, in his wake. And that reduced bank reserves to 3%, which allows banks to create basically $30,000 of imaginary credit on every $1,000 of reserves. And it used to be that the reserves were gold and silver. Now the reserves are nothing more than Federal Reserve credit. So it's the Ponzi game, if you will, or the derivatives market in credit, just kept getting more and more wild as we left hard money behind. These things have been engineered. They're not accidental. There are people who profit from them, but most people don't. And since most people don't, they just automatically think that nobody does.
Several times in our history, we've had some of the even politicians wake up to the central banking scam. And, of course, right at the beginning, we had the Continentals, not worth Continental, and the Constitution was supposed to go to coining money instead of printing money.
Yeah.
So there were obviously some people awake fighting this problem.
Well, when the Constitution was framed, there were members of the constitutional delegation who were most emphatically opposed to legal tender, because they had already been through the experience. As I mentioned earlier, in 1690, Massachusetts had issued the first legal tender bills of credit. Now, they were promises to pay silver, which they just didn't happen to have. And it took quite a while before those instruments became worthless. And that's one of the problems with this thing. I mean, anybody who touches a red-hot stove knows within a few seconds that he's just done something that he needs to correct immediately. And the correction takes no time at all, because the cause and effect relationship is very instantaneously determined. But when you begin issuing credit instruments, what happens is a relative artificial prosperity. And it usually takes about, 25 to 50 years before the public begins to perceive that there's something inherently wrong with the system that they've adopted. And it's this long time interval between the cause and the effect which creates the confusion in the public mind, particularly concerning bills of credit. And we had founding fathers, for example, Roger Sherman, who was one of the delegates from Connecticut. He was instrumental in inserting into the Constitution the provision, Article 1, Section 10, Paragraph 1, which said that no state shall coin money, emit bills of credit, or make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. The reason they put that protection in there, a specific prohibition against the states doing that, is because all of the states had tried it, and the results were disastrous. But again, it took quite a while before everybody finally figured it out. And even in the long term, not everybody was in agreement that that was a problem. Then you had the prohibition against the federal government issuing any legal tender. Now, people say, well, there's no such prohibition. Well, yes, there is, but it isn't expressed because the Constitution is a document that grants powers. And any power that's not granted, if you go to the Ninth and the Tenth Amendment, any power that's not granted isn't there. So you go to Article 1, Section 8, and Paragraph 5, and it says the Congress shall have the power to coin money, not to print, not to create, not even to issue, because the power of original issue still resides with the people who were to go out and mine the gold or silver, bring it to a treasury office, an assay office, and have it converted into coin, and then they were the ones who were supposed to put it into circulation. The American people have no clue that that's how it was supposed to have been done. George Washington, in fact, provided the first silver for minting silver coins, and he provided that out of his own personal silver plate. Okay? So we were the ones who were supposed to provide it. And the Constitution stands as a bulwark against federal tyranny because of its prohibition against legal tender. But almost nobody even conceives of that as being a potential protection, let alone what I believe to be the greatest protection that the American people ever had against federal tyranny. Of course, the Bible stands against federal tyranny too, but unfortunately, the Constitution, like the Bible, they're only written documents, and they can't enforce themselves. The public has to become aware and has to know how to respond to the problems in some sort of an active, sort of lawful way. And the public doesn't know how to do that.
Well, the Bible specifically condemns usury, which is any interest on money, and the death penalty is what's called for usury.
Yeah, in fact, the Coinage Act of April 2nd, 1792, which was the first Coinage Act, and it was made in pursuance with the constitutional provisions given to Congress to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and a foreign coin, and to fix a standard of weights and measures. The Coinage Act provided a death penalty as well. And that death penalty appears in Section 19 of an act that only had 20 sections in the entire act. Very short piece of legislation, and very sensible piece of legislation. That Section 19 said that anyone in the way of a Treasury officer who was found guilty of debasing, that means reducing the weight or purity or both of the gold or silver coinage, would be guilty of a felony and shall suffer death. The Founding Fathers took that as a very serious offense. It was a violation of a public trust. But again, the public is not aware of the provisions found in that Coinage Act. Most people don't even know that act exists. But when you start debasing coinage and when you start charging usury, you have in your hands the powers to destroy civilization itself. And we're watching that happen as ours unravels, because every problem that every one of your listeners considers to be an evil that they may personally be up against or that we as a people are up against, every one of those problems is funded by a credit system over which the public has no control and is unable to stop. And we had a system whereby the public was supposed to be kings and queens, if you will, in their own castle. And we had this concept of public servants. Not every people on the planet recognizes government as a servant of the people. Most people in the world recognize government as the master, the sovereign, if you will. But anybody knows, if he's ever been in business, that if you have an employee, and think of Congress as being our employees for a moment, when you have an employee and he doesn't perform well, you fire him. And most people think, yeah, well, we fire the congressman by voting in another thief. Because generally that's what we wind up with, is just another one of them. But let's just suppose for a moment that you had a public official who you couldn't get rid of. When you told him you didn't want him there, he said, I'm staying anyway. Or you had an employee who refused to leave. what's your next option other than calling the sheriff or the chief of police or somebody and bringing them in and, you know, bringing them to your store or a place of business and having them haul this man off physically? Your next option is to stop paying him. The American people do not have the ability to exercise that option. Once we demonetized gold in 1933-34 and demonetized silver between 1963 and 1968, from that point forward, the American people lost their collective ability to stop paying Washington. Washington does not need the American public. Washington operates without the public's consent or approval, or without the public's money because the public has no money. The federal government gets all of that funny money that it wants for absolutely nothing. It doesn't pay one solitary red cent of any tangible thing to print a $100 Federal Reserve note or a $10 Federal Reserve note or to write a government check. They don't need the American public when it comes to taxes. What they need from the public is what the public produces. And the public is still eager to give up what they produce in exchange for numbers called dollars, which Congress gets absolutely free. It's 100% theft in favor of the first issuer. And the Bible forbids theft, even if it's government doing it. It doesn't say that you can steal if you've got a good program going. Nobody gets to steal under the oversight of a godly government. But that's exactly the system that we
have. Wasn't it Jackson who said that the banks are more dangerous, or a central bank is more dangerous than standing armies?
That was Thomas Jefferson, which is kind of peculiar because Jefferson actually died in debt. I mean, he was a person who was a bit dichotomous. It's kind of hard to figure him out. I mean, he had weaknesses like all of us do. He was flesh. He died as a debtor, but yet he recognized in his own infirmity as a man who kind of lusted after a few things and went in debt to get them. He recognized that debt was a cruel oppressor. And he said that he feared banks more than standing armies. It was Andrew Jackson who said that the bankers were a den of thieves, and he promised by the eternal God that he would rout them out. And he did, in effect, when he vetoed the recharter of the Second Bank of the United States. That charter was supposed to come up for renewal, I think it was 1836, but it came up for renewal in 1832, came up early, because Mr. Biddle, who was the CEO, I guess you'd call it, of that bank, was hoping to get that bill through Congress in a rather advantageous political sort of way, and so he brought it up early. And Jackson and his aide-de-camp, you might say, in the Senate, Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri, his nickname or his handle or whatever you want to call it was Old Bullion. Jackson was Old Hickory. So he had Old Hickory and Old Bullion, stalwarts against the Second Bank of the United States. And in fact, I've been going through a series on that in my own broadcast, and we've just basically brought that one time to kind of a close. But Jackson was able to influence the American people's thinking with regards to a central bank so effectively that we didn't have a third central bank until actually 1914. When the Federal Reserve System finally opened its doors. The American people were resistant to it because they remembered the warnings of Andrew Jackson, even though they didn't fully understand banking.
Of course, the bankers are behind the politicians that we look upon as traitors because they control them through their finances. The scripture says the love of money is the root of all evil.
And Solomon reminds
many areas.
And Solomon reminds us in Proverbs 22:7 that the rich ruleth over the poor. I've never heard of the poor people ruling over the rich, no matter how many communist supporters there are out there who believe in the dictatorship of the proletariat. The fact is, the proletariat has never dictated to the rich. Solomon was correct back then. That correctness stands to today. He said that the rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. So who's the borrower and who's the lender? Well, the Federal Reserve alleges to be the lender. Congress alleges to be the borrower. So who's the master and who's the servant in that relationship? Obviously, Congress is the servant. They do the Federal Reserve's bidding. What I'd like to point out, however, is that if the people could ever come to a knowledge of the truth and a belief in it, they would come to an understanding that the Federal Reserve System has made no loan to Congress, and that, in effect, the Federal Reserve is the debtor. But unfortunately, in order to accept that position, you'd have to correctly define your terms, and you'd have to give up, the American people would have to give up on their notion of being able to live the good life, they believe, a life of instant gratification, by playing with the banks and the bankers in a world of credit. And the average American has no intention, to the best of my knowledge, my perception of the public, of ever giving up this wonderful idea that they can go in debt and spend today, and get today, what it was that if they had just waited a while, they would have been able to afford without having to pay the interest burden. But we're an avaricious people, and so we have to repent of that covetous nature, you know, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods, and so forth and so on. And Americans are very covetous.
The love of money that I just mentioned.
And that word money there, the love of money is actually defined when you go to Strong's and look up the words, it's the love of silver. So silver, again, was used as money, both in the New Scriptures and in the Old. And again, for thousands of years, that's what our people used as money. The whole idea of a credit system like we have today is really quite new in the historical setting. One of the other myths, you mentioned myths early on in the broadcast. One of the myths that people in the Israel message, people of the populist persuasion, bought into quite a while ago, was this myth that in merry old England, from about 1100 A.D. right on up through maybe the 1800s, that England used sticks of wood called tally sticks, and that those circulated for 726 years as money. That myth, Mike, goes back to about the year 1935. I remember talking with Scott Mooney on this subject. He did some research. He did a little bit more research on the subject than I did. I couldn't find any original research that showed that they were used as money. And I was talking with him one day. He had written several books on usury. He says, I can't trace it back any further than 1935. Gertrude Coogan, who wrote a book called The Money Creators. And she alleges that it was used, they were used as money, but she cited no original source material. Other writers came along behind her, Peter Cook, Richard Kelly Hoskins, and others. In fact, the current writers and speakers would include people like Alan Brown and Bill Still, and to some degree, Stephen Zarlenga of the American Monetary Institute. There are many others, Theodore Thorin and Richard F. Warner, who wrote a book back in the 80s. It was called The Truth in Money Book. I've got a third edition here on my desk. I mean, these people are absolutely... They're wrong. I mean, but they all quote each other. Sometimes they give it, they will give credit to who they're quoting. Others will simply plagiarize. But they're all basically saying the same thing. In fact, I can open up a page here in, this Truth in Money book. And they will say, for example, this is on page 258 of their third edition. They say the tally sticks as a form of money were introduced in England by King Henry I. King Henry I built in a demand for tally stick money by requiring, doesn't that sound like a free country? Requiring that they be used to pay taxes. And they go on in this vein. The fact is, tally sticks were just what they say they are. They were record-keeping devices that allowed people to an economic transaction to tally that transaction. And the transaction specifically involved the producers of wealth under the king and their payment of taxes to the king, and the taxes were paid in gold and silver. And what the tally sticks were carbon copies, if you will. They were split lengthwise. They had notches in them. Then the notches indicated the denomination, if you will, or the monetary payment. But it was payment in money or payment in kind. which would have been produce from the land. And each party, the king's exchequer or treasury, they would keep a half. And the person who had produced the goods would keep the other half. And the tally stick had the name of the person on the stick. So that when he paid his taxes, first in the spring, around Easter, and then in the fall, around Michaelmas, he would come into the exchequer. He could bring with him his previous tally to show that he had paid his previous half-year taxes. And all they had to match up at the exchequer was the half on his tally stick in his account. And yet, myth believers in the populist camp say that the king used this stuff as money, which meant that he would have been able to steal from the producer with sticks of wood, which he would have gotten for nothing. And that the reason we had matched halves was to prevent counterfeiting. I'd ask your listeners to contemplate for just 1 minute how long they think it would take to match a suspected half stick that might have been counterfeit with all of the kindling, that I will call it, in the king's treasury. How long would it take to match up a suspected counterfeit piece of wood with all of the halves that the king had in the exchequer? We're talking tons of wood. So get somebody in your... Let anybody in your audience just contemplate that. In fact, go out and split some firewood. Split a pile of firewood and scatter it around your yard. That would be like scattering the tally sticks around the economy. And then go try to match up those sticks of wood, because they'll only go together one way. See how long that would take you. And yet, Dick Hoskins, I mean, I like the man, but Dick Hoskins said that that could be done instantaneously. You must be kidding. Hey, there's no way that could have been accomplished instantaneously. In fact, I doubt it could have been accomplished, let alone instantaneously. So that's one of the many myths that's circulating around in our circle of acquaintances concerning this money issue.
That's what I was about to say. Speaking of myths or other unlawful solutions advocated by patriots, how about some of the others? Lincoln Greenbacks, nationalizing the Federal Reserve, GNP.
Lincoln Greenbacks are soft tally sticks. And the reason they tout the tally sticks is because if they can establish some sort of a historical precedence, that gives credence to the idea that the government should, or even has a prerogative, to issue numbers on soft tally sticks called Fed notes or U.S. notes. But what they don't tell their audience, they're very careful to avoid pointing out that what they propose is strict compliance, I mean to the letter, of the Communist Manifesto at the fifth plank. Now, when all a populist has to do, all kinds of people buy into these ideas, and I'm not critical of people, accepting a false notion. I mean, we all do that from time to time. A teacher, we're told, you know, be ye not many masters, for ye heap to yourselves a greater condemnation, James 4:12 or thereabouts. A teacher has a greater weight of responsibility than a student. And that's what a master is. And we've got all kinds of students out here who will pick up a newspaper like American Free Press. Most readers, I would be willing to bet that most readers of American Free Press do not realize that people like Christopher Petherick, who is the editor-in-chief, believes in, and he will use the word, fiat money. I just can't imagine that the average Constitution-waving American Free Press reader actually believes in fiat money. If he does, he doesn't believe in the Constitution, because the Constitution does not make any provision whatsoever, even for a gold certificate, 100% redeemable. There is no provision for that. John Langdon, who was one of the constitutional delegates from New Hampshire, said with respect to striking out the words "and emit bills," most people don't realize that in the constitutional draft Congress was to be given the power to coin money and emit bills. That should have appeared in Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 5. The reason it doesn't is because that was voted out by a vote of 9-2-2. I had to make sure I got my numbers right. 9-2. In fact, John Langdon said that if those words, and emit bills, were to remain in the Constitution, he would reject the whole plan. What that meant was he would reject the Constitution itself. Why? Because that, to him, was the most significant protection of the, for the American people against federal tyranny. You give the federal government the power to counterfeit legally and steal whatever it wants from the American people and compel them to take those numbers of nothing through legal tender acts. That, to him, and I agree with him, that was the most decisive power that the federal government would seek if it could get it, and it now has it. It gets it by sharing it with a private corporation, which wasn't bound by the Constitution. That's why the symbiosis between the Federal Reserve and Congress is so important to understand. Congress doesn't stand opposed to the Fed. They love it. They share in the proceeds. But they are restricted specifically by the Constitution. A private Federal Reserve Bank is not. And so they hired the Fed to do what they couldn't do. And the Fed gives them an open checkbook, and they get to share in the proceeds, okay? And they get to play God. What these people with the populace want to do is they want to nationalize the Fed. And that way, the Federal Reserve moves into the federal government. It is no longer an agency acting on behalf of the federal government. And it will no longer, if the populace have their way, it will no longer be listed under F in the telephone book. It will become government because it will then take over the government. And that's what Denis Kucinich's bill proposes. If people will get a copy of that bill, it proposes that the Federal Reserve be incorporated into the executive branch of the government. And employees of the Federal Reserve system will become federal employees. It also provides for 8% interest for those people who believe that this is going to be an interest-free system. It's not. It's a two-tier system. Every credit system must have interest. I repeat, every credit system, no matter how great and wonderful it is, has to have interest because that's one of the most decisive tools for regulating the supply of credit. Because these people plan to mathematically regulate it. You read their books, and they do that. Part of the tools, one of the tools they use, is interest. The only deal is that the federal government isn't going to pay any interest. The federal government's going to get the principal for nothing. They won't have to charge themselves any interest. They'll let the states have it, the principal, on loan, but without interest. But if you needed any funny money, you'll pay 8% interest, as will any business. Now, they also hold to themselves the right to revise the legislation. So if they need more interest to keep from creating a runaway inflationary system, because credit costs nothing to produce, therefore, to prevent an interest-free frenzy of funny money creation, which would cause phenomenal runaway inflation, they will have interest, and they can raise or lower interest to make the cost of borrowing nothing, whatever it is that they need in order to regulate the quantity. They're playing God with a system that God never intended anybody play with.
Well, inflation is a type of tax on the people because doesn't hold its value like the paper money, just like gold and silver.
Yeah, inflation is actually, I look upon inflation as actually one of three taxes that are inherent to a credit system. The first tax that the public pays to government is when the public gives up goods and services, either a product or their labor, in exchange for a number which is prefixed with a dollar sign. The federal government got the dollar sign numbers instruments for nothing. The public doesn't, unless, of course, they're on welfare. Now, when you give up your labor to get that instrument, that is a confiscation of that wealth in favor of the government. It's a 100% confiscation. And then that Federal Reserve note becomes your receipt for the tax you've just paid. The second tax that the public pays is the depreciation tax. The longer they hold that instrument before they try to rob their neighbor with it and get compensated, they're not going to pay their neighbor because they weren't paid themselves. What they're going to do is they're going to pass that instrument on to the next sucker. That will constitute compensation, not payment. People use the word payment very loosely. Most people don't understand what the word means. It's unfortunate. Most economic terminology, the average person does not honestly know what these words mean. Yet they use them all the time because everybody else they talk to doesn't know what they mean either. But when that instrument is held by the person who received it, the longer he holds it, the less he can get for it when he tries to steal from his neighbor. That's the depreciation tax that most people call inflation. The third tax is when the government has the audacity to have you send some of those confiscatory instruments, licenses to steal, if you will, back to the same government that got them for free in the first place. It's what I call a system of triple taxation. And the public does not know how to get around that. In fact, it was John Maynard Keynes, the economist, who said that this was the most effective, efficient means for any government to use when it could find no other means to fund its operations. I will quote that directly from John Maynard Keynes. I'll take it from Tract, which was written by John Maynard Keynes, and this would be found at page 37 and page 52 of that book, but I'm actually going to be quoting from the 1980 annual report of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, Virginia, wherein they say, quote, Keynes argues that inflation is a method of taxation which the government uses to secure the command over real resources, resources just as real as those obtained by ordinary taxation. Regarding the inflation tax, he says, that a government can live by this means when it can live by no other. It is the form of taxation which the public find hardest to evade, and even the weakest government can enforce when it can enforce nothing else. It's extremely important that people understand this system of theft. It is legalized theft. And I hate to keep picking on the populace, you know, and American Free Press and others, but theft is the system. And what they want to do is they don't want the Federal Reserve and the Treasury to share in the theft. They want to nationalize the Fed so that it is the federal government that allegedly gets the full benefit of stealing from the American public. And
now,
they use all...
This is a big subject, and would you like at this point to mention your book, Lawful Money versus Legal Plunder? Because a lot of the quotes and the other concepts you mentioned, I know are in there, and give the audience an opportunity to send and read more on the subject.
Well, I appreciate that, Mike. I have been working on this book. I think I'm done with it. I mean, I've worked on this book for about 2 years, and I've probably got close to 2,000 hours in it. And the book is only 104 pages long. It actually started off at 80 pages and went to 92, I think it was, and then it went to 100. It's been through probably something like 60 different iterations. And I have just kept trying to refine it so that a book this small says as much as it says. There is no fluff in this book. It's entitled Lawful Money Plaintiff versus Legal Plunder Defendant. If a person wanted to order it, all he's got to do is write the letters LMLP, you know, Lawful Money versus Legal Plunder. I know what he's talking about. The subtitle of the book is An Indictment of Criminal Fraud and Theft Perpetrated Against the Non-Bank Public by the International Banking Cartel. I wrote it with that title and with the purpose in mind of defending the forefathers who saw fit, in their wisdom, to protect us from what it is that we are currently enduring. They actually tried to establish a system that was probably as close to a biblical system as you can get, the problem being that the public could never quite make up its mind to say no to bank credit. And the fact that we have authorized banking on our shores created a hybrid type system where you are trying to operate with credit and money at the same time. And when you do that, when you legalize theft, where the banks can create more credit instruments than there is gold and silver on deposit, for example, in the early 1800s, state chartered banks were allowed to operate on a 25% reserve. That meant with $1,000 in gold or silver on deposit, they could create $4,000 in credit and put that into circulation. By doing that, that reduced the value of the $1,000 of the money that was in the bank through a law of competitive bidding, just like bidding at an auction. The more dollars that are bid at an auction, the more people who are bidding on that tractor, the greater the likelihood that that tractor is going to go for a higher price than if you only had two or three people bidding on the tractor, you see. And so that's what happens when you pull gold and silver off the street, which is what banks did by granting interest to depositors. That was the inducement to get the depositor to put his gold and silver in the bank. Then the bank turned around, used that deposit as a lever to create four times as many dollars in imaginary credit, and that would theoretically cause a fourfold increase in prices. Now, we never did have a fourfold increase in prices in the 1800s, because we just didn't have a uniform, all of the gold and silver going into the bank vaults and credit instruments replacing them. But we've certainly had that problem since the Federal Reserve was created. Now, if a person wants to order the book, they can order the book from me directly. I guess they ought to know where to do that. I'm at 33563. That's 33563. State Route 537. Graysville, gray as in the color, Graysville, Ohio, 45734. And the book is available for 15 babble bucks, as we call it, 15 bucks. No checks, no, you know, just send the Fed notes if you want, if you want the book. And that's shipping and handling, a whole nine yards, and that's first class shipping. I think the book is well worthwhile. I put a lot of my time in it. It's got color photographs of bills. We deal with all kinds of the myths that people have bought into. I've gotten very good response from the people who have read it. It's a weighty book for as small as it is, though. It's not light reading. But I think you will know more about banking, and you'll understand economics far better than almost anybody you've ever met, I believe, in just 104 pages. But you'll probably have to read the book more than once.
I'd like to mention here that we also have a couple books on money. One is a comic book. Got cartoons in it. It's got an introduction by our guest, Bruce McCarthy, 2-page introduction, but most of it is cartoons, comic book, and explains banking and usury, and it's something easy to understand for most people. We ask $3 for that, and we also have a book called Babylon's Money by Pastor Bertrand Compre, and we ask $2 for that. Let me right here give out our phone number. We have just a little bit of time left, but if you would like to call and make your comments, you can call 877-924-7722 or 888-656-4115. I'll repeat that, 877-924-7722. You can remember that by 877-YAWS-RACE or 888-656-4115. Either one of those numbers is toll free. This is a big subject, and I suggest that you read some more on it, get Bruce's book or some of ours, and of course we carry some other literature on various subjects too. Bruce, what can we expect in the future? I know
more of the same.
Interior crisis.
we can expect more of the same. The direction that we're going is the direction we're going to continue going. The public doesn't have much to say about it. Not that the public can't make any difference in terms of their own personal behavior. I do offer some solutions in the book, both a national solution as well as personal. Since I don't see America going through any genuine repentance, then it's really an academic exercise with regards to how America could return to the use of hard money. But people expect me to put that sort of a thing in a book or during a presentation, and I've done so. Again, there are so many myths that undergird this. I mean, there are people, for example, maybe even in your audience, who believe that we have a free enterprise system. We don't have a free enterprise system. We didn't have a free enterprise system when FDR started to tamper with it back in 1933-34. A free enterprise system, according to Black's Law Dictionary, is the right, that'd be the right of everyone, the right to conduct a legitimate business for profit. Well, if banking is a legitimate business, and it seems to act as though it were, then you and I should be able to do what they do. But if you do it, you go to prison. We don't have a free enterprise system when somebody else can create money out of nothing. Actually, they don't create money, they create credit. And then can confiscate what you produce, and you're required to give up your goods and services to get it. That's not a free enterprise system. It's not even a capitalist system. Because Federal Reserve note, capital, bank, credit, I should say, is not capital. Capital is wealth used to beget more wealth. And wealth is something that...
The Bible tells us to come out from among them and be ye separate. We're also told to be not partakers of her sin, lest we receive her plagues. We've certainly received the plagues for an unlawful money system. But this is difficult, being in the Babylonian system, to come out from among them. I know you, for a number of years, lived the best you could with using lawful money, silver primarily. But it's a very difficult thing. Well, how would you suggest that people come out from this system the best they can at this time?
Well, I mean, you do it in a logical order. I mean, you don't want to jump into the swimming pool at the deep end if you don't know how to swim. And most of us don't know how to swim outside of this system. A lot of people come under conviction to get out of debt. I won't go into that, but obviously that is part of the process. Another part of the process would be to bypass third-party records keepers. No credit cards, no debit cards, no checking accounts. In fact, people become far more frugal, far more wise with their spending, if you will, when they have to actually reach into their pocket and even pull out green rags instead of writing numbers in a checkbook. Okay?
I think our oppressors know this. For instance, all federal government checks, well, I guess it was the first of this month, have been stopped for direct deposit. And that prevents a lot of people from spending, if you can call it that, even Federal Reserve bucks. We have a caller, Clayton. Clayton, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. I'd like to ask your guest, does he see the Fed and the government in Washington, D.C. moving us into a completely electronic monetary system?
Oh, yeah. That's the direction that they've been going for quite a while. In fact, the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston put out a publication back in 1980. It was called Electronic Money and the Payment Mechanism. And they said, I think it was on page 59, I don't have that book in front of me right now, but they said that the conviction was that money was information. In fact, I can actually quote from it because it's on the back of my book, and I have a copy of my book in front of me. And they said here, for example, advances in computer and communications technology are paving the way for major changes in banking practices, many of them based upon the premise that money is information. Now, that comes from Electronic Money and the Payments Mechanism, Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, page 59. That was printed back in 1980. That's quite a while ago. If money is information, whose information is it? It's the information about the alleged debtor. Because information is power. And as Lord Acton had said, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The Federal Reserve System doesn't lend anything tangible to anybody. What it does is it collects information from people who honestly think they went into debt. That information is then used to regulate a population, to regulate its behavior and its consumption. That's what our system operates on. And that's what's so diabolical about what people call a cashless system. Actually, America went cashless back in 1965. Cash is money, Curlin versus Young. There is no cash in banks. Okay? People can't cash checks. There's no cash in checking accounts. The Federal Reserve admits that. But what we use is information. And that information is what tracks everybody. It allows them to establish what your political affiliation is, your sexual orientation, where you go on vacation, how much you spend, and so forth and so on. That information is used to foment policy. The word policy comes from the old French word police, which means to police or to control, to regulate. And our system is certainly one of policy. And yes, indeed, you've asked a good question, and it's a most relevant question. We are going straight electronic because there is nothing being used as money right now. When you pass a Federal Reserve note, you're not using paper as money. If you were using paper as money, then the paper would increase in proportion to the size of the denomination. In other words, a $100 bill would be 100 times more paper than a $1 bill. But it isn't, because what you're using is just raw numbers. And so we could go electronic. Once we went to the Fed note system with no redemption in gold or silver, from that point right then and there, 1965, we could have gone instantly to electronic. They've made this a progressive
change. We have a little over a minute left. Would you like to kind of wrap up your thoughts tonight?
Yeah, I guess I can do that. I could probably close out with what Clayton was saying, that we're heading for a 100% electronic information transfer system. And the debit cards will replace Fed notes. It's only a matter of time. Federal Reserve notes are not used in very many transactions, even now. And there's a time coming when there won't be a Fed note left in circulation. And you will not have any privacy with any transaction you perform. Nor will you be able to bypass this system, because they can just simply electronically debit from your account whatever they want to take out of your account, with or without your knowledge, and certainly with or without your permission.
I'd like to thank you, Bruce, for being our guest tonight. We're just about out of time. I'd urge people to write for Bruce's book or write to us for the comic book Temple of Imaginary Money or Babylon's Money by Pastor Tom Frey. Our address will be given at the end of the broadcast. You want to give your address one more time?
33563 State Route 537, Graysville, Ohio 45734. Just write to BGM.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being on the broadcast tonight.
Thank you very much, Mike, for having me.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.